Hello and welcome to this Canadian Opera Company podcast. My name is Jana Wichelow, and today I'm speaking with tenor Russell Thomas. Russell has just made his COC and role debut as the title character in The Tales of Hoffmann. This is very exciting for us to welcome a singer who's been acclaimed for his powerful and beautiful tenor voice, one which is full of passion yet always in control. Russell, welcome and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now I have to ask you first off, how have you enjoyed the rehearsal process here? You've discovered a new role, a new production, and a new city.
The rehearsal process here has been great. It's been a little overwhelming at times. The role of Hoffmann is probably one of the longest ones in the repertoire. Toronto is a very expensive city. That part of things has not been enjoyable, but yeah, I've enjoyed the process. I've enjoyed getting to know the role of Hoffmann and my first Hoffmann. And under these conditions, it's been great.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you build up stamina for something like a 3.5-hour opera where you spend so much of the time on stage?
I do nothing. I do absolutely nothing on the day of a performance. I try not to warm up so much throughout the day. Many of my colleagues, sometimes they warm up so much and then they get on stage and they're stressed out and the voice doesn't last and stay fresh through the end of their performance. To avoid that, I warm up very little. I steam a lot and I try to warm up through the first part of the performance. Mm-hmm. And this opera is composed in a way that it gives the tenor a little time to get warmed up before the big stuff starts to happen.
I wonder if Offenbach knew that.
I'm pretty sure he did. many composers who wrote well for the voice knew how to give you a chance to sort of ease into it.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, most the only, I say the one exception is probably for tenor that I can think of is Radames, because he comes out immediately with his big aria, and the beginning of the opera. That's probably the only exception. But again, if you're a good Radames, it's set up in a way. The aria is set up in a way that you can sing it quite easily.
Yeah. Well, now you're originally from Miami, is that right?
Yes.
Can you tell us how your opera career came to be?
Well, that's a long story. But when I was 8 years old, I came home from grade school one day and turned on the radio and just happened to be on the classical music station. And I heard, I know now, was Oberon of Weber with Placido Domingo and Birgit Nilsson. Wow. And I didn't know what I was hearing. I had no clue at the time. But I was intrigued by these sounds that they were making and how they made them. Like, how did this happen? Like, how is this possible? I had never heard those sounds before. So every day after school, I would come and turn back on that same station and listen again and again and again. When I was 12, I saw my first opera, which is Carmen. And that changed my life.
Now, how did that come about?
My grandmother, we were on vacation in New York, and she knew that I had, that I loved the opera, and she was speaking to a friend of hers, and the friend said, well, you know, you're in New York, the best operas are in New York, and I think it was New York City Opera we went to, and I saw Carmen for the first time, and fell in love with it, you know, the violence and the energy that score had, and everything that was happening on the stage, the dancers, and it was visually stunning and musically, you know, it was amazing. It was one of these things, it was like, it really was a life-altering moment for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And although at 12, you don't know that what you want to do, what I said to my grandmother at the time, this is what I want to do with my life. And I'm lucky to be able to have done that.
That's wonderful. Now, were you singing at that point already?
I was in choir in elementary school. Nothing, I didn't have my first voice lesson until I graduated high school.
Oh, wow.
And decided to go to college and major in music. I met a wonderful woman in high school, when I was in high school, Joy Davidson. In Florida, we have what's called the Florida Vocal Association. And basically, it gives high school students the opportunity to sing with their choirs in basically a competition. You're not placed in the competition. You're giving evaluations, like superior, excellent, poor, whatever, ratings. Joy Davidson came in, and she had a great career of her own, singing at La Scala, at the Met, and all these great places. And she came in to help us with our solos, and I was chosen to give a solo. And after hearing me sing my solo, she said, you know, you could really make a career of this.
Oh.
And I was already scheduled to go to the military academy, to the Naval Academy. And that completely changed my life that day. That day really changed everything. Because when someone validated this idea that I could be an opera singer, it changed everything.
The Navy or the opera? I've never heard that, yeah. That choice.
Yeah, it was it was politics. I have this love of politics. Yeah. So in order to be a great politician, it's easier if you had military service.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was the reasoning behind the military.
That's interesting. Well, you never know. One day maybe the opera singing politician.
Maybe.
Someone's got to do it.
Maybe. Domingo did everything else, so why not, right?
Now, you were part of the Seattle Opera Young Artist Program, and then you joined the Metz Lindemann Program. And I'm just curious, I mean, two really, really fine apprenticeship programs. How what sort of impact did that have on your career and training?
Well, they were great for me. The funny thing is, before I went into the Seattle Opera Young Artist Program, I never auditioned for it. I was ready to give up singing altogether, actually, because I was not enjoying it anymore at a certain point. I wasn't enjoying it anymore. A conductor, Stephen Lord, heard that I had decided that I probably wasn't gonna sing anymore, and I had done a young artist program in St. Louis, and Seattle Opera, for some reason or another, lost their Rodolfo for their young artist production. And Stephen called me and asked and said he had recommended me for this and asked if I wanted to do it. And at first I said no. And then because they said that I had to do the whole young artist program. And I said, well, if I can only do Rodolfo, then I'll do Rodolfo. But I don't want to do the whole young artist program. But then some negotiating and they changed my mind. And that was great for me. I met Spate Jenkins and I made my official stage debut there this year in Attila. And I met people from the Met, and one day I got called to Spate Jenkins' office, and he said that the Met wanted me to come and audition, and they flew me in, and I went and auditioned for them. So that sort of was another turn in my life, and without the Met, I would have never met Peter Sellers and John Adams.
Mm-hmm.
I would have never met Ken Noda, who I have collaborated with so many times in recital, and who's been a great mentor of mine. And James Levine, you know, Ken Noda is the assistant to James Levine. And James Levine, I've worked with quite a few times, in Boston and at the Met. Without that program, I would have never had those opportunities.
That's wonderful. Now, shall we play a piece from the Tales of Hoffmann?
Sure. What about the Kleinzack aria?
Kleinzack, there you go. So we'll hear Plácido Domingo in a 1972 recording. This is on the Decca label. And Richard Bonning conducts the orchestra of the Suisse Romande. And choruses of Radio Suisse Romande, Pro Arte of Lausanne, and Du Brassus.
Otro de sol. cervelle. Qui diable peins-tu là, Klein Zach?
Klein Zach, je parle de...
Qui?
Non, personne, rien.
Now, Russell, you've won a number of highly recognized competitions, most recently the first prize winner of the Vinyas competition in Barcelona, and at the Competizione dell'Opera in Dresden. I was wondering what impact competing and winning has on a younger artist.
Winning has been great because the money helps further my career. You know, I can take lessons and have coachings. A couple of presenters have engaged me to work in their theaters, such as Frankfurt and Basel, Switzerland as well. And now the Royal Opera Covent Garden, I'll make my debut next season. And Deutsche Oper Berlin as well, I'll make my debut in 2013. All of these places I met through, they heard me first through this competition, through these competitions. And that's been very helpful. I don't think that I would have been able to make my debut in Frankfurt had I not won first prize at these competitions. And they, and also these companies, members of these companies sat on the juries of these competitions.
Yeah.
So that's always a great thing.
So it's a focus, basically. It's focusing a light on you.
Definitely.
Drawing attention.
Yeah. Definitely. And I was, I believe, the first African-American male to ever win the Vinyas competition, which for me is a great achievement, but to some it means very little, but to me it means a lot.
Yeah.
That's a major, major feat for me.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, you sing a lot of different roles, very wide-ranging in style and time period, such as appearances as Tamino in The Magic Flute and Andres in Bartsek, both at the Met.
Yes.
Right? And Verdi's Duke in Rigoletto in Chile. But your career has also featured great success in John Adams' work. And after Hoffman here in Toronto, you're going to be involved in the world premiere of his The Gospel According to the Other Mary with the Los Angeles Philharmonic under Gustavo Dudamel. And there's going to be American and European tours. So can you tell us about this piece and the process so far?
I'm still learning it. I received the first act of it at the end of January. And it needed a lot of revisions on my part. So John made a lot of corrections.
Is that when you were singing it, you suggested to him?
Oh, before I even opened my mouth to sing it, when I looked at the score, I knew that there needed to be revisions. And I contacted John Adams. And the beautiful thing about working with a living composer is that you can have this dialogue about something like this. And being the first one to sing it, I sort of feel like I have a responsibility to make sure that everybody that has to sing this after me can do so comfortably.
Future tenors will thank
you. Right, right. I enjoy John Adams. I've worked with he and Peter Sellers quite a lot. I've worked with him as composer and conductor, and Peter Sellers as librettist and director. They're great friends of mine and major supporters of my career. This piece is basically his answer to his own El Nino. El Nino was about the birth of Christ, and this piece is basically about the crucifixion of Christ from the perspective of Mary Magdalene.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, there's a modern story being told in this as well. Musically, it's very exciting. There's typical John Adams minimalism, but there's also melodies that No You Won't Go Away Humming, but as a singer, you appreciate the tonality, the tonal moments, and those types of things. But rhythmically, it's very challenging, and I think it's going to be a big success for John Adams. I think it will be a big success.
Which part are you playing?
The role of Lazarus.
Oh, okay.
Yes, the role of Lazarus, which I don't know if this is true, but he's Mary Magdalene's brother.
I don't know. Yeah.
So, yeah, and there's a great, two great scenes in the first act, scenes 4 and 5 for Lazarus about after he'd been risen from the dead by Christ. Mm-hmm. And these are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful scenes. I mean, they're so challenging. They're so difficult to learn. But they're great. I'm looking forward to it.
That's wonderful. Wish you all the best with it. Now, speaking of the future, upcoming engagements include your debuts with the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, as you
yes.
said. What are you going to be doing?
Gabriele Adorno and Simon Boccanegra.
Oh, lovely.
Yes.
And Deutsche Oper Berlin. And you'll also be returning to the Met and Seattle.
Yes.
What roles will you be doing there?
At the Met, Clemente di Tito next season.
Yeah.
And Seattle, Tales of Hoffman.
Oh, interesting.
And in Berlin, Don Carlos.
Oh, my goodness. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Are there any dream roles? I mean, I keep referring to you as a young singer. You've already got so many roles that you've done, but are there any dream roles in the future you're yearning to sing?
There are a few. I mean, people usually ask, you know, favorite role. There's no favorite role, you know, but there are things that I would like to sing over time in my career. Carmen, for instance, is the first opera I saw. I've never done a José. I would love to do a Don José. Trovatore, great Verdi opera.
Mm-hmm.
Otello, great Verdi opera. Mm-hmm. You know, Calaf. I don't see myself hear myself as a Puccini singer, but I would love to sing Calaf in Turandot.
Yeah.
I think it would be a great role for me.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Is your grandma still with you?
Oh, yes. I don't know if she's ever seen me in a staged opera. I can't recall if my grandmother's actually ever seen me in a staged opera, but she's come to recitals and she's come to concert work because
yeah.
I've done a lot of that sort of in the South, and you know, she travels easily to those places.
Yeah.
She really enjoys it. She loves the fact that I have success in this. And my family, a large part of my family, did not think it would be possible. They
mm-hmm.
really didn't. One, from ignorance of the art form, and two, because they saw the fact that a black man singing opera in America doesn't really happen all so often.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned to someone in an interview recently, in the States, we have now fewer star black singers than we did at the time of segregation in the States, which is a terrible statistic, but at the time of the segregation in America in the 60s, you had at least 10 star black singers at the time.
Any idea why?
And now they don't exist. I think a lot of it has to do with exposure to the art form. People just don't know about it. If you don't see it, you don't hear it, you don't know it exists,
yeah.
So you don't want to try to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, luckily, when I heard and had an interest in it, my family encouraged me to find out more. For Christmas, instead of getting video games and toys, I got recordings of operas
mm-hmm.
because it was what I wanted, you know. I think it's education. I think it's education. And in America, unfortunately, they're reducing. I'm sort of going on a speech. I do this a lot about arts education. But arts education in America is non-existent, especially
mm-hmm.
in the South, unfortunately. In Louisiana, they've taken it almost completely out of grade school and middle school. Florida, luckily, has a great program for the arts in high schools and middle schools. Great programs. Georgia, where I live now, there is almost non-existent. They're stripping it away unless you go to a specialized school where it has an arts focus. You probably won't get a music class or a choir class, which all of us have had at some point in our lives. There's a generation of kids that are growing up that won't have that.
That's devastating. You think about, there's been so many people here talking about the fact that an arts education or musical training apart from everything else, apart from the fact that children are exposed to music, which is wonderful, actually helps them, like, cross-training with other skills.
Well, of course. I was just actually today doing some research on the same issue or subject because of a project that I'm involved with in Atlanta. But I read a statistic that showed that students that were involved in the performing arts scored about 50 to 100 points higher on college entrance exams than those that had no training whatsoever in the SATs, ACTs, and sort of college entrance exams that people have to take for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But performing arts students generally excelled at those or scored higher. That's a very important statistic. And for American politicians, for instance, who say that, you know, we need to educate our students better and we need to do this, that, and the other, getting the students more educated and competitive on an international market in science and math, they continue, though, to strip away arts education, which could help these kids excel in science and math.
Well, it seems like an overwhelming problem, but you speak about it so well. Maybe you'll have an impact.
You know, it's something that I'm very passionate about, yeah, because I know it changed my life. You know, yeah, I know it had a major impact on my life. I excelled at science and math. Of my family members, I'm maybe the second or third one to ever go to college. Mm-hmm. So I think that it will have a lasting impact if politicians continue to strip away arts education from schools in America, mm-hmm, unfortunately.
Russell, what do you like to do when you're not working?
You know, I'm the most boring person ever, because I, you know, our careers are so busy with moving around and traveling and doing stuff, mm-hmm, you know, and so when I'm not busy doing stuff, I like to be home. Mm-hmm. I like to be home watching television, sleeping in my own bed, you know, that I barely ever get to sleep in. But no, I love going out. I love having a drink with my friends, and I love cooking, and I try to do that as much as I possibly can to keep my life normal, mm-hmm, you know. I love cooking. So those things, yeah. But I love having a good martini and hanging out with friends. I love it.
Sounds good. Have you discovered the St. Lawrence Market?
No. I haven't been around much here in Toronto.
We'll have to talk when we stop recording.
All right.
I have to see that. Well, Russell, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure getting to know you.
Thank you.
For more information about the recording we listened to and the COC's production of The Tales of Hoffman, please visit our website at coc.ca, where you can also purchase tickets and other season-related recordings online. This is Jana Wichelow. Please join me again in this continuing series of podcasts sponsored by DECA, the opera label.